Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Aparuta de sangama tassa tavara e sorvantabha munjantu satang. So a week, the winter's retreat has passed. So this afternoon I'll reflect on contentment. And William Blake, English poet, once said, contentment is heaven itself. So if you want to go to heaven, be content. Now, you can't make yourself content because the world we experience through the senses, through the body and the senses, is not content. It's changing, as you may have noticed. So how can you become content when your whole experience of life is about restlessness, movement, change, believing in the, imagining the future or remembering the past? These are, the future doesn't lead to contentment nor to the past. So this is for you to find out for yourselves. So contentment being heaven itself, and living in a form that's basically not content, and identifying with the form, then we suffer the restlessness, the changing conditions. When they change the way we don't want them to, we suffer. Now, on a winter's retreat, as I mentioned last week about the trying to settle down to a routine, a scheduled routine of group meditation, walking practice, and how the whole body, usually in an ordinary daily life, is busy doing things, thinking, planning, fantasizing, whatever. And then suddenly we're asked to concentrate, to relax, to be aware. And so awareness is our ability to be aware of restlessness and discontent. So what you can to realize contentment, you must recognize discontentment is what you're experiencing through the senses, through the body. And that which realize that is aware, when we talk about awareness or mindfulness, you know, it's not something you can manufacture. It's just here and now being aware of the way it is. It's like this. Like at this moment, it's this way, and you are open to it. You're not judging it. You're not saying, I want it to be another way, or I would like it to be this way for a long time, or after a week's group meditation to feel some sense of peace and contentment and then wanting it to be forever, then we're discontented again. So after having given many meditation retreats, I've noticed that people get very tranquil as time goes by because of the ordered lifestyle of where everything is programmed, and you meet and you walk and you eat according to a schedule. And there's noble silence, and you put away your iPhones, iPads, telephones, I hope, and then you can experience, after a week's experience of being the watcher or the witness to the way it is, because of the lack of sensory stimulation, then you do feel content or peaceful, tranquil. At least we can call that tranquility. And we like that. That's very nice. And then we want to know how we can be tranquil in daily life. When we go home, when we have to go to work, get busy and do things, meet with people, talk with people, chat with people, then how can I be this tranquil when I'm chatting with somebody who's upset or who is criticizing me? So the retreat situation is like it's like spoon feeding. You're being fed. You don't have to go shopping looking for food. You don't have to cook. You don't have to do anything but just eat what is available. But when you go back home, or when the actual group meditations end, and the winter's retreat is over, then we have work to do, duties to perform, and we get caught up into our critical faculties and being aware of other monks, other nuns who irritate us or don't perform their duties to the standard that we expect. We get caught up in our critical faculties, which is a total lack of contentment. Like living with other people is always a challenge because it's people don't always agree with me, don't always please me, don't always act the way I think they should, or there's always something that you can feel frustrated or annoyed or disturbed by when you're talking with other people. When you're by yourself, then you can have all kinds of memories of successes and failures in your life, of rewards and punishments. So like memory, and we just try to remember the happy moments of our life. And so then that we can find a level of peace or at least some form of happiness by happy memories. But they also are restless, they change, you can't sustain them, keep them. And when you're caught in the turmoil of life, of samsara, of society, then it's like this, it's the way it is. Because as I've said many times, experience is always here and now. So enlightenment is here and now. Contentment is here and now. And through mindfulness or awareness, conscious awareness, then that's the gate, the door to the deathless. The deathless is the reality of contentment behind all the noise, all the confusion, all the movement, restlessness of samsara. That which is awareness itself, conscious awareness, is its very nature, is contented. It doesn't seek or want or regret or care about anything. So that's why this word mindfulness or awareness is so important, because it, like the other day I got a letter from a person who wants me to teach her how to be mindful while climbing the stairs. Now how do you, what am I going to say about mindfulness climbing the stairs? Climbing the stairs is like this. And when you're climbing the stairs, especially someone like myself, when I climb upstairs or downstairs, because of my disabilities, it's very, I have to be totally aware of where I put in my feet. But we can, when we're young, we can run upstairs thinking about something else, totally unrelated to climbing the stairs. But being mindful of climbing the stairs is the way it is. It's like this. Whatever way you climb them, whether you can do it quickly or with agility, or you have to be very careful, otherwise you might fall down the stairs. The weather, like today, is like this. So when it's cold, so that's a judgment, isn't it? We think, we feel the cold piercing through our robes, our clothes, and we think, oh, it's so cold, and we get caught up with maybe aversion to the cold, maybe we like the cold. But mindfulness of the weather is like this, it's opening to the way it is. It's not about having totally indifference to weather, trying to say it's all just the same, because it's not. The weather is a sankhara, it changes according to conditions. But what doesn't change according to conditions, because it is unconditioned, is conscious awareness. So I bring back this to like consciousness. This is a subject of great interest these days, because with all the modern technology and comfort that many of us experience through the material world, at this stage of our life, at this time in the countries we live in, then it's, you know, I look at my life, and fortunately I was born in 1934, at the middle of the economic depression, and the United States was in a terrible mess at that time. Then it was the Second World War, then it was the Korean War, then it was the Vietnam War, then there was a level of peace, and now there's wars again, starting seemingly endless conflicts all over the planet. Because human beings, we're our very nature, because we think and we're living in a sense, very sensitive state all the time. You know, we'd have desires, we follow our desires for power, for status, for fame, for for all the good things. But so much of us, when we don't receive those kind of accolades or opportunities, then we feel like failures, or we're ordinary, no good, stupid, or, you know, we can go from one extreme wanting to be beautiful and intelligent and appreciated and loved to being totally depressed, feeling worthless. And that, what is that? That kind of, that's thinking, isn't it? And thinking is restless activity. When you observe yourself thinking, you're observing restlessness is like this. And yet, how do we stop thinking? The idea of stopping thinking. I should stop thinking, but can you actually will yourself as a person, a personality that thinks, just stop thinking? And you can do it like holding your breath. Compared to that, then you eventually have to start thinking again, because your very conditioning is about thinking. And thinking is always about discontentment, about how things should be, or what's wrong with the way it is. So being the witness, the Bhutto, the Buddha, observing the way it is, the knowing Dhamma, it's through Buddha, through awareness, through mindfulness, that we know the Dhamma. But we can't know the Dhamma as a person. Like, no matter how many scriptures you read or memorize or chants, you know all about Dhamma. You know what the scriptures say, the suttas, what the Tibetans say, the Chinese say about Dhamma. And that's all very good. There's nothing wrong with that. But it's still words. Like nirvana, or Dhamma, or enlightenment, are just words. And so when we try to attain Dhamma, nirvana, or enlightenment, we form an image of nirvana. So just like the word contentment is just a word, and you have an idea of what it is, why you should be content, like the samanas, the bhikkhus, the siladharas should be content with the four requisites. That's what you should be. You have a roof over your head for the night, you have food in your alms bowls, you have robes, and medicine for illness, four requisites, and be content with that. That's what you should be content with that. So then, but can you as a person really be content with the four requisites? You know, this is my observing my own personality. My personality is never content. My ego, likes the idea of contentment. I like the word, the ideal of contentment, about being content with the four requisites. It's very, very idealistic. But can you, as a person, as a monk or a nun, just make yourself content with the four requisites? What is given to you, the food given to you, the robes that you receive, the shelter for the night, the medicine that you receive when you're ill. Can you just be content with that? And you should be, according to the ideal. But to know it in terms of Dhamma is, no matter what you feel, if you are content or grateful, that's very good. But most of us, the modern Western world is, we're not content with rag robes. You know, the idea of bhangsakula cloth, where you can go and pick up rags that the lay people have thrown away to make our robes. When, you know, try to convince yourself you're content with going around Berkhamsted looking for rags to make a robe. You know, it's, you can imagine that. Food in the alms bowl, or the shelter for the night. Medicine for illness. The lowest standard of medicine, according to the suttas, is fermented cow's urine. Now, how many of us could be contented when we're ill? Somebody comes with a glass of fermented cow's urine. Is that possible? You know, it's, so what are these standards? It's putting, it's taking the lowest possible condition, and then everything we get is better than that. In my 57 years as a bhikkhu, I've never had fermented cow's urine. And I hope I never have. But also reflecting that that's the lowest standard. And to imagine yourself contented with that and feel guilty when you want proper medicine, what we consider modern allopathic medicine or homeopathic medicine. So these standards like rag robes, fermented cow's urine, you go bindabat with an alms bowl, and whatever people put into your alms bowl, you take with gratitude. And if you're vegetarian, somebody puts a hamburger in your alms bowl, then you feel annoyed or averse. Or vegan, or a special diet, you know, then, but these are discontentment. So it isn't that you can be contented with what you get in your alms bowl, with the robes that you have, or the shelter you have for the night, or the medicine available. But you can at least be aware of discontentment. So this awareness is a gate to the deathless. And you can't imagine the deathless. Just try to imagine deathlessness. Because imagination is a sankhara. It's a thing that arises and ceases. And it can't do it. It can't imagine the unborn, uncreated, unformed, unconditioned. You can imagine nibbana, like the word nirvana is used quite ordinarily, and even in Western world. I remember in seeing a beauty salon called the Nirvana Beauty Salon and things like this. So that's a word for some ideal of beauty, of perfection that we can imagine. We can imagine the best possible words and thoughts, images of nirvana as being absolutely perfect. But that imagination, every image, no matter how beautiful or grand it might be, is something that arises and ceases. And daily life isn't nirvana, it's about samsara, about feeling of love and hate, like and dislike. So the wars, it's about hate, isn't it? Prejudice, racial prejudice, gender prejudices, taking sides with the right or the left, because the samsara is about heaven and hell, right and wrong, good and bad, love and hate, war and peace. And so war is like, can you be peaceful with the way Britain is at this time? Is it, you know, is it, we're not at war with anybody, but we support wars and things like this. We can have strong views about we should just be peaceful and non-aligned with any particular side, or with the right side, with the Western world, with democracy. These are right, and those that conflict with that are wrong. And that's thinking again. Thinking is all about right and wrong, about yourself or about the world you live in, the family you live in, the society. So the deathless, or the gate to the deathless, or the deathless itself, what's left when you stop thinking, holding to thoughts, clinging to ideas and ideals, is consciousness. When you fall asleep, does consciousness fall asleep? Or the body, the senses, fall asleep. And then when you awake, you're conscious again. You're conscious through the senses. But then when we sleep, we can also have dreams. So imagination can operate still, even though we don't see, hear, smell, taste, touch. The images in a dream can manifest. We start dreaming. And that's why dreams are so irrational. They can be every which way. Wherein, when we're awake, we're not sleeping anymore, we're not dreaming, then we have a kind of standard of the way the world is. England is here. Scotland is north of England. France is across the channel. And on and on like that, we have fixed ideas about the locations of countries. Where is the boundary between Scotland and England? Can you visually see it? Is it Hadrian's Wall? Is that the legal boundary between Scotland and England? Or Wales? You know, so we can fight over these boundaries, and really, British history, it's about fighting. Between Lancashire and Yorkshire, just in the north, about boundaries, whose property is this? So that leads to discontentment. When somebody starts impinging on what I consider my property, we get angry and irate and want to have a fight with them, sue them, take them to court, murder them, do something to protect what you hold as yours, the boundaries you imagine, which really don't exist, that you can't find, but you can believe. So belief is a form of clinging to ideas, some logical, reasonable ideals, like democracy we regard as reasonable, logical, fair, just. And then fascism is wrong, it's evil. So we have the democracy, which is good, and fascism, which is bad. But these are just ideas that human beings create in their minds. We're conditioned, culturally, educationally, socially conditioned. So we tend to believe without really reflecting on the way things are. So in vipassana or insight meditation practices, it's about investigating. Sankharas are like this. What arises ceases, what begins ends, what is born dies. So sankharas are, you know, that's cause and effect. If you're not born, you don't die. So reason and logic are about thinking. Does God exist? Is there a really supreme being, a God that exists? And we might believe that or we might disbelieve it. Because you're trying to prove whether God exists or doesn't exist. The endless tricks of the mind can justify or disqualify that. Because where is God? Where can you, you know, the word itself, it's just a three-letter word. And yet we can totally believe in something we can't see or know or feel or taste or touch or see because it's good. According to most religions, God is good. So we attach to that and believe that somebody doesn't believe in God is bad, is evil, is heretical. There are all kinds of names that are applied to atheists or people that deny the existence of God. But what is it, whether God exists or doesn't exist, is a matter of belief. Now, meditation, vipassana meditation, isn't about belief, but investigating to find out for yourself. You believe in Buddha, or Dhamma, or Sangha, you know, they're all good beliefs according to my view. Buddha is very, you know, I like Buddha, I like Buddha images, I like Theravada Buddhism. Dhamma is absolute reality, which I like. I'd like to wake up to absolute reality. Sangha is living in a sangha of men and women who practice according to the right way, keeping the precepts, being unselfish. In the sangha, those who are content with the four requisites. The sangha is another ideal, which is good. It's a good ideal. So, investigation, sati sampajanya, samavichaya, is encouraged. That's the whole point of this kind of life that we're leaving. We're living is that we really have the opportunity, the encouragement, the conditions to investigate life as we experience it in whatever way we experience this monastic form. So that's what the Four Noble Truths is about. It's a teaching to, not about saying you should believe in anything or deny everything, but you're not, it's not about should anymore. It's kind of beautiful invitation to investigate, starting with something so universally experienced as suffering, noble truth. Because samsara is about birth and death, about heaven and hell. Contentment comes through understanding that discontentment is through attachment to ideas, to thoughts, to images, to views and conceptions. The ideal of a perfect sangha, of devoted practitioners, of men and women, is an ideal, a beautiful ideal, but as we all know, living in a sangha is not about perfect meditators, perfect people practicing according to the ideal, but investigating their experience of life as they experience in these forms. As bhikkhus, as samaneras, as siladharas, as anagarikas. It's like this. So it's not asking you to just shut up and surrender to life. It's not about shutting up and be content with what you get as an order or how you should be, but it's an encouragement to awaken to the opportunity to investigate. So these reflections are how I see what I can offer to give that kind of encouragement. Because I realize how fortunate it is to have a teaching that encourages us to investigate life rather than to tell us what is right or wrong or what we should or shouldn't do or believe or not believe. So contentment is the nature of consciousness, is consciousness itself. Not the sensory consciousness, because the senses, the eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, brain, they don't know contentment because they're conditioned to be discontented. Because we imagine, no matter how wealthy we are or fortunate we are, there's still, it's still the habits of discontentment that operate in our lives. So our, like, billionaires, people with power, absolute power, and billions of dollars or euros, are they content with the wealth that they have and the power and the kind of respect they get for being wealthy? Is that, can you be content if you have $1 billion in the bank? Because you're still conditioned to be discontented. Because you can imagine $2 billion. And $1 billion is a good show, you can imagine something better than that. So in the world of sankharas, you can always imagine something better. So I like to think of, like in my own experience in Thailand, with Wat Pa Phong, with Lungpa Cha. After the second year with him, I was discontented. I wanted to go off on a kind of we wake or live isolated alone, and not have to deal with all the busyness of a monastic order, a busy, increasingly well-known, famous monastery in that part of Thailand. So I go to another place, to a mountaintop, trying to live alone and be contented, but I was not. I never suffered so much as being alone on a mountaintop. So I went back to Wat Phrapong, and I was more content with what I had. I was glad to be back. But then discontentment, when, you know, there's always some place I'd like better than Wat Phrapong. And then setting up Wat Nanachat was a challenge. Starting a monastery, when I had no experience of doing that, of being an Ajahn, I had only 8 Pansas when I was sent off to establish Wat Nanachat. And I was discontented with that, because the monks that I was with were not perfect monks. And I wasn't, you know, I just felt, I didn't know how to be a teacher or how to establish anything except by following what I'd learned living with Lungpa Cha. So that was trying to emulate Ajahn Chah, my image of Ajahn Chah, my imagination of Ajahn Chah. Didn't work. It wasn't, because I'm not Ajahn Chah. And the conditions are very different than the beginning of Wat Phrapong. So eventually I figured out that what I really liked about Lungpa Cha, that he wasn't trying to be anybody. He wasn't trying to copy Ajahn Mun or any other great teacher that he had lived with. He was himself content within his own life and his conscious awareness that wasn't personal, wasn't just him trying to be an Ajahn or a founder of a monastery or anyone else. So this is learning to really trust in awareness. Because that is the gate to the deathless, to nibbana, to enlightenment. And it's here and now. It's not something you imagine. It's not something special. It's just that, you know, we complicate, you know, look at the animal world and look at the human realm, the human animals. You know, we make problems out of everything. Because we think. So modern life has become incredibly complicated with our high tech, having iPhones, computers, then there's artificial intelligence and internet and on like that. These are kind of brilliant tools, but they do complicate life. So then the idea, we should not have iPhones, iPads, internet. We should get rid of all that high technology and go back to very basic things. And that's another ideal. ideal of some, just a pure, simple life in the forest, listening to the birds singing, watching the flowers grow, and that's a beautiful ideal. So ideals are beautiful, but samsara is not ideal. It's not an ideal, it's about birth and death, right and wrong, dark and light, good and bad. And ideals are about how things should be. If everything was good, if there was no bad, if there was no evil, if there were no evil forces, dark forces, if there was no war, no conflict, if we all just got along, full of loving kindness, compassion, and understanding, that's a beautiful ideal. But living in Sangha, just notice how much, you know, you can, in metta meditation retreats, you can feel loving kindness for all sentient beings. But then in daily life, can you retain that grand view when the person sitting next to you is annoying you? And so this is where mindfulness is the path to the deathless. The deathless is conscious awareness, here and now. It's something you have already. It's what you really are. But you don't notice it because you're caught in views, opinions, ideals, resentments, criticisms. Because that's the samsara is like this. It's all about right and wrong. Samsara is suffering, birth and death. Beginning and ending. And this is Buddha pointed to so clearly in his basic teachings. All conditions are impermanent. All sankharas, all phenomena, his very nature is change. If it has a beginning, it has an ending, it's a cause and effect, it's karma. So the word karma is best defined as cause and effect, like to do good, you receive good, to do bad, you receive bad, and teachings like this are easily provable. Like I found just metta practice, spreading loving kindness to myself or to the world, to all sentient beings. After a while, you know, you become very happy because metta is very good. But then you go into some difficult situation where you're being disparaged or judged unfairly and you feel like you don't feel metta, you feel this way because the conditions have changed from a controlled metta retreat, silent, where grand thoughts can arise, and metta is one of the most beautiful thoughts, love for all sentient beings. But in daily life experience, can we actually feel love or metta that we experience through just through a silent meditation retreat? To apply that to, we can intellectualize it. You know, we should feel metta for somebody who's treating me unfairly, injustice. So I noticed years ago when I was being criticized unfairly, I felt very indignant. Indignation, righteous indignation. That's not metta, is it? Or do I have metta for righteous indignation, meaning righteous indignation is like this, in which you're using the very emotion, strong emotion of righteous indignation through wisdom rather than through attachment, through right and wrong, or what's fair or just or what should be. So even the problems of life, one's own disabilities or character tendencies, whatever they might be, they're karma. So, but your true nature isn't karma. Your true nature is awareness, conscious awareness. And it's learning to trust that. And then using experience through the form that you have to experience sensory consciousness through to reflect on that all conditions are impermanent and that conscious awareness isn't personal. It's not Ajahn Sumit or Ajahn Chah or anybody. So during this winter's retreat, I encourage you to reflect in this way. Whatever happens to you during this winter time, no matter the external conditions or the internal ones, it's all grist for the mill. It's all good stuff to be aware. Anger is like this. Greed is like this. Delusion is like this. And in that, you can only do that not through willing yourself, but through really trusting in awareness, opening up, relaxing, being the witness rather than the owner of indignation or anger or resentment. So I offer this as a reflection.